Shalom Aleichem, sweetest friend. This year should be a special schus. Ravi Marini Mimaraz, Shikhi, Schus Moshe Beshnevetz, Moshe Mordechai, Kayaka Vera Beth Michal Tisbasia. And we were going to be discussing the idea of natural law, Hamishpat HaTiv'i. There is quite a bit of material about this that I'd like to cover in other shiurim as well. This hopefully will be the first, I hope. And I just wanted to start with the great legend of our time, Hagaon HaRav Bleich Shlita, who discusses this in a number of places. And then I'd like to go on to other sources as well, B'li Neder, B'li Neder, B'li Neder. And we will begin as follows. Natural law theorists assert that fundamental principles of morality need not be taught or legislated. Rather, they are innate and can be apprehended by the light of reason alone. Those who disclaim a knowledge of such ingrained principles are regarded as either liars or as lacking in a faculty of moral awareness. Their opponents deny that there are a priori propositions. Rather, moral principles are the product of cultural, societal, pragmatic, legal and or pedagogical factors. As Professor William K. Francana famously described the controversy, natural law theorists depict their detractors as suffering from moral blindness, while philosophers who reject such a priori notions claim that natural law theorists suffer from moral hallucination. So in his book, The Naturalistic Fallacy, in his article, Naturalistic Fallacy, in the Journal of Mind, Volume 48, Number 192, written in October of 1939. Wow, it's going back a little bit. Natural law is not in vogue among contemporary academics and intellectuals. One of the major concerns raised in the confirmation hearing regarding Clarence Thomas's nomination to the United States Supreme Court was that in his youth, he had authored an article espousing a natural law position. Nevertheless, the Declaration of Independence professes a belief that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The belief that humans are divinely endowed with inalienable rights is natural law in a theological guise. The phrase is borrowed from John Locke's two treatises of civil government, where the rights are identified as life, liberty, and enjoyment of property. Prosecutors of the Nuremberg trials recognized that the defendant's conduct was not only permitted, but mandated by the legal system to which they were held accountable. The charge that they knew that their actions were indefensible because they had a compelling because they had a compelling self-evident duty to obey a higher law. Several decades later, Lieutenant William Calley was court-martialed for following orders and massacring the civilian inhabitants of My Lai during the Vietnam War. Vestiges of natural law may remain and be unrecognized even when a comprehensive doctrine of natural law is vehemently denied. Elements of natural law doctrine may find expression, albeit unacknowledged, in various legal systems. The term natural law, or its Hebrew equivalent, rarely appears in Jewish legal or philosophical literature, and indeed, its first appearance is in the writing of Rabbi Yosef Albo in the 15th century. It's clear that the bedrock of Jewish law is revelation rather than reason. Nevertheless, in the book Judaism and Natural Law, The Philosophical Quest of Philosophy, Ethics, and Law and Halacha, printed in Yerushalayim 2013, from pages 85 to 124, Rav Bleich sought to identify elements of natural law reflected in rabbinic writings. What we are doing here is supplementary to that endeavor and designed to show that natural law notions find expression in more instances than one might expect. In Sefer Bereishis, we have accounts of a number of oaths involving the Avos, including Avram's bris with Avimelech supported by an oath. Kisham nishbu shneihem in Bereishis 21:31, and a similar covenant between Yitzchak and Avimelech that they swore to each to his brother. Avram also demanded an oath from his servant Eliezer with regard to the genealogical identity of the bride. Eliezer was to choose for Yitzchak in Bereishis 24:9, and Yaakov insisted that Esav swear an oath confirming the sale of his bechorah in Bereishis 25:13. Later, Yosef swore to his father that he would bury him in the land of Canaan in Bereishis 47:31, and Yosef in turn quotes his brothers to swear that when their descendants would be redeemed from Egypt, they would reinter him in the promised land in Bereishis Nun Chof Hei. Rav Yehuda Rosenis, the 18th century scholar in his famous Mishnah Lamelech in Hilchos Melachim 10:7, Dibur HaMaschil Shuv Ra'isi, is the first to question the efficacy of those oaths. Those oaths were all pre-Sinaitic. A prohibition against violating an oath is not one of the Sheva Mitzvot B'nai Noach. The Mishnah Lamelech is content to explain the oaths sworn by our Avos on the basis of the tradition that the Avos were well aware of the contents of the corpus of law to be revealed at Sinai and were meticulous in their observance of the full complement of the Taliag Mitzvahs. Mishnah Lamelech is willing to ascribe the same degree of observance to Eliezer, who is regarded by the Chachomim as a highly meritorious individual. But, notes the Mishnah Lamelech, that cannot be said of Esav. Halavai, Esav should keep the Sheva Mitzvahs. And what about Avimelech swearing to Avram and Yitzchak? The problem would be obviated if it could be established that the Noachites are somehow bound by their oaths, even though such an obligation is not explicitly posited in the Noachite code. Indeed, the Talmud Yerushalmi in Nazir 9:1 records a controversy with regard to whether Noachites are bound by the admonition of Lo Yachil Dvoroi, he shall not profane his word, in Bamidbar Lamed Gimel. One school of thought takes the position that since the pasuk is addressed to Jews, non-Jews have no similar constraint. Another school of thought not only posits an isser against false oaths binding upon Jew and Gentile alike, but maintains that only Jews, circumstances permitting, can avail themselves of a process of nullification of a vow, whereas non-Jews are entirely denied such an option. The first opinion simply underscores the problem with regard to pre-Sinaitic oaths. The second opinion renders those oaths meaningful but fails to explain why the commandment of the Lo'achel Dvaro, ostensibly addressed solely to Jews, as are the other mitzvahs commanded at Sinai, should also be binding upon non-Jews. In presenting what he himself concedes is a strained reading of the text of the Talmud Yerushalmi, the Mishnah Lamelech asserts that the controversy recorded in that source should be understood as limited to vows, but that an obligation to swear truthfully is subsumed in the commandments of the Noahide Code, and hence is binding upon both Jews and non-Jews. Mishnah Lamelech asserts that a false oath or abrogation of an oath undertaken in conjunction with invocation of the divine name constitutes an avizra, an accessory, or an appurtenance of blasphemy. Falsely invoking the name of God is a profanation of his name and is incorporated in the prohibition against blasphemy, a transgression that is indeed one of the Sheva Mitzvahs, the name Noach. falsely invoking the name of God is a giduf, is a profanation of his name, and is incorporated in the prohibition against blasphemy. As such, the prohibition is binding upon all human beings from the time of Adam, to whom, as stated by the Gemara in Sanhedrin 56a, the Noahide code, with the exception of the prohibition against consuming flesh torn from a living animal, Evi Menachai, was commanded. So here we have that it's giduf. It's a, if one swears in the name of God, then it's giduf. A similar view was expressed by Rav Pinchas Halevi Horowitz. Renowned as the author of the Hafla and Hamakne in his Pelush Panim Yafos, by Midbar 32, the Panim Yafos comments that the Pasuk, introducing the biblical section dealing with vows, "This is the matter which Hashem commanded you," should not be understood as referring to a newly transmitted matter concerning oaths, but to an earlier commanded matter, in other words, the prohibition against blasphemy, that is also integral to the Noahide code. The Panim Yafos, unlike numerous other authorities, concedes that Noahides were later excluded from the prohibition on the basis of Talmudic exegesis, as evident from the discussion in the Talmud Yerushalmi, Nazir 9.1. The Mishnah Lamelech himself expresses some reservation with regard to his thesis, both because of the apparent thrust of the discussion reported in the Talmud Yerushalmi, and because an earlier authority, Rav Shmuel Yaffe Ashkenazi, in his Pelush and the Medrash, Yifei Torah, Bereishis Rabbah, 34.7, Divor Maschil, Ve'alak Shafim, assumes that non-Jews are not commanded to abjure false oaths. Those comments notwithstanding, the concept of a prohibition that is binding even in the absence of a revealed dogmatic commandment is not entirely unknown in Jewish law. One such admonition is expressly formulated by the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Tafayin Dalet Amud Aleph. Chazal posited three cardinal prohibitions that demand martyrdom rather than transgression, one of which is homicide. Confronted with an ultimatum to kill another person or to forfeit one's own life, the Gemara declares that one dare not take the life of another in order to save oneself. In response to the query from where is this derived, the Gemara replies, "Svarahu, my chazis to damni dachsum k'tfei," who says your blood is redder than the blood of your fellow. Svar in this context connotes a principle readily intuited by human reason. The parity existing between all lives, we are told, requires no scriptural basis. The principle can be apprehended by human reason, even in the absence of dogmatic revelation. Not only is the infinite, and hence equal, value of every life known a priori, but the implication of that awareness as governing human conduct is also readily apprehended by the human intellect. Reason commands that a person desist from homicide even when his own life is at stake. That is the sole natural law prohibition explicitly formulated by Chazal. Elsewhere we see svara means common sense, but here we're talking about natural law. There are other medieval authorities who recognized other binding natural law prohibitions, as well. Assuming that reason recognizes the moral odium associated with homicide and also has the power to relegate human activity, even to the extent of providing authority for the punishment for ignoring the dictate of reason, to what purpose did the deity dogmatically prohibit that which is already intuited as being forbidden? If the legislative authority of reason is on par with that of revelation, formal scriptural prohibition of homicide would appear to be redundant. Although not formulated as a resolution of this problem, the commentary of Yaakov Mecklenburg Haksava Kabbalah, Bereshis Tes He, serves to answer the question. Regarding homicide, the Torah says, Miyad Ish Achiv, from the hand of a man's brother, I will require the blood of man. Haksava Kabbalah draws attention to the incongruous depiction of the murderer as the brother of his victim. The murderer presumably acts out of malice. Violence is the antithesis of brotherhood. Haksava Kabbalah observes that, at times, taking a human life may be motivated not by malice, but by compassion. Euthanasia is designed to spare the patient from further suffering. As such, is it indeed an act of love, not of hatred? Thus, brotherly, quote-unquote, or compassionate homicide is expressly forbidden. Nevertheless, it need not be argued that euthanasia is forbidden a priori as a natural law prohibition. If euthanasia is not permitted a prohibited a priori, the biblical injunction is not superfluous. It is necessary to encompass the rare instances in which reason does not mandate renunciation of the prerogative of taking the life of a fellow human being. There is one other Talmudic occurrence of the term svara in association with establishment of a normative rule of conduct. The Gemara in Brachas, Lamed Hei Amud Aleph, questions the source of the halachic requirement for pronouncing a bracha before eating. The response is that the prescription is a matter of svara. If you have to bench after eating, it's kal b'chomer, you have to make a bracha before eating. If svara is an independent source of halacha requiring confirmation, neither in the form of a biblical verse nor by means of rabbinic decree, the requirement mandated by reason ought to have the status of a d'oraisa. Yet it is evident from a related discussion of the Gemara in Brachas 21a that the obligation to make a bracha before eating is only rabbinic. The Pnei Yoshua, in his Perish to Brachas 35a, resolves the inconsistency by positing a controversy between two Talmudic discussions. Pnei Yoshua affirms that the principle of Svar invoked by Brachas 35a is designed to establish a biblical obligation, while asserting that medieval halachic decisors assign priority to the discussion of Brachas 21a in ruling that the obligation is of rabbinic origin. Rabbi Yecheskel Landau in the Tzlach in Brachas 35a dismisses the Pnei Yoshua's thesis with the observation that were the obligation to recite a bracha before partaking of divine bounty to be the product of reason, the obligation should be binding upon non-Jews as well as Jews. The corpus of law revealed at Sinai is binding only upon the children of Israel who are the recipients of that revelation. The Noahide code was revealed to Adam and hence is binding upon all of humanity. However, if reason is endowed with legislative authority, since Jews and non-Jews are equally endowed with reason, the obligation to recite a bracha, if it is indeed the product of reason, should be incumbent upon non-Jews as well. No hint of that effect is found in any rabbinic source. Problem is that it's based on a kal v'chomer, and the kal v'chomer is predicated upon benching. If you bench, you have to make a bracha before, but the goyim don't have benching. So that would be a question on the tzlach's contention with the Pnei Yoshua. The tzlach asserts that the Kavachomer argument is not in the nature of a Kavachomer Gemura. It's not an absolute, clearly intuited a priori argument. Hence, its conclusion cannot be said to be compelled by reason. Apparently, a person required to praise Hashem for the bounty of which he has partaken should be prompted by that obligation also to recognize that a similar obligation is occasioned by God's gift of the wherewithal to assuage his hunger. But apparently the sense of gratitude experienced by a person upon having enjoyed a benefit may be greater than the gratitude felt before actually benefiting from the bounty bestowed upon him. The argument then, according to Tzlach, may be said to appeal to reason, but cannot be regarded as compelled by reason. Only obligations compelled by reason can be regarded as generating a normative natural law obligation. There is at least one other natural law obligation posited by Judaism, although not expressly formulated, and certainly not categorized in that manner. In the Rambam's enumeration of the commandments, of the Torah, I am the Lord your God constitutes the first of the Ten Commandments, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, Rambam, Sefer HaMitzvos, Mitzvos Essay Number 1, and Hilchos Yisodei HaTorah 1:6. That pasuk for Rambam is not a declarative sentence, but a commandment to acknowledge the existence of Hashem. Thus, belief in God is a mitzvah, i.e. it must be accepted because God commands its acceptance. The first and most immediate question is, how can belief be commanded? Belief is an epistemological state, and hence can hardly be commanded. Either one recognizes the truth of a proposition, or one does not. How beliefs are formed is a matter to be addressed by epistemologists and psychologists. But when there is no belief, human will cannot cause it to come into being. Conversely, if belief exists, a commandment to believe is superfluous. According to Rambam, for those present at Sinai, a commandment to believe was indeed superfluous. Revelation at Sinai was in the nature of prophecy. The prophetic state for Rambam is an intellectual experience, an experience that is self-validating and not subject to error. Phenomenological experiences are always veridical, if I pronounce that word correctly. It is only our characterization of an interpretation of the phenomenon that is subject to error. Psychosomatic pain is pain. It is only attribution of the pain to a physical cause that is subject to error. Similarly, prophecy for Rambam is qualitatively different from, and hence cannot be mistaken for, any other phenomenon. Prophetic perception of the deity is not subject to error. Hence, for the recipients of revelation, that phenomenon constituted an undeniable awareness of the presence of God. Intellectual proofs designed to demonstrate the veridical, meaning coinciding with reality, truthful, nature of a phenomenological experience are unnecessary and entirely superfluous. Similarly, experiential perception of God is a far stronger proof of his existence than any philosophical proof could possibly be. The commandment regarding belief in God is necessary solely for those who are not privileged to be present at Sinai and to participate in that revelation. The commandment then, as is the case with all commandments, is to transmit its content to future generations, but unlike other commandments, this commandment, as applied to the generation of Sinai, was superfluous. Validation of that which is already known and accepted is unnecessary, as expressed by Yehuda Levi in the Kuzari 1:25. Later generations are aware of the existence of Hashem because such knowledge was passed on to them by an earlier generation. But this explains only what it means to say that a person is commanded to believe that God exists. The more challenging problem is how can that mitzvah be incorporated in a catalog of mitzvahs? The concept of a commandment is vacuous unless there is a commander. There cannot be a mitzvah, a commandment, but for a mitzaveh, a commander, the notion of a mitzaveh must precede any notion of a mitzvah. Put somewhat differently, a person obeys because he is commanded to obey. But why must he obey the commander? The answer cannot be that he must obey because such was the commander's command, because such an answer is circular in nature. To say that one need not obey the commander's command other than because that is what the commander has commanded is to beg the question. To answer in that manner is to confess that an obligation of obedience arises solely from the corpus of that which has been commanded, but left unexplicated is the antecedent basis that compels a person to obey that which is commanded. Indeed, Rambam's predecessor, in the endeavor to identify each of the 613 commandments of Simcha Kayara and the Baal Lachos Gedolos, omitted belief in God from his enumeration of the mitzvahs. Ramban, in his commentary to the Rambam Sefer HaMitzvahs, Mitzvah Essay Number 1, explains that omission. And he writes, however, belief in his existence, may he be exalted, that he, meaning Hashem, made known to us by means of signs and wonders and by revelation of the Shekhinah to our eyes, is the principle and root from which the mitzvahs were born and is not to be counted in their calculation. Ramban's assumption of why Baal Lachos Gedolos fails to include belief in God in his list of 613 commandments is of course correct as a matter of formal logic. To include that principle in a listing of commandments would undermine the notion of a mitzvah. As the ancient paradox put it, all Cretans are liars. I am a Cretan, therefore I am a liar. But if I am a liar, then not all Cretans are liars. If not all Cretans are liars, then when I say I am a liar, that is a true statement. But if all Cretans are liars is a true statement, then I am also a liar. And if so, I lie when I say all Cretans are liars. Wow. Bertrand Russell resolved that paradox by explaining that a proposition describing a class of propositions is not a member of the class it describes. Since such a proposition is outside the class which it describes, it serves to establish the matrix in terms of which the propositions comprising a class of propositions is to be understood. All Cretans are liars is a meta-proposition describing an antecedent condition against which further propositions must be tested. Thus, I am the Lord your God cannot be a mitzvah on par with other mitzvahs, since mitzvahs have viability only because there is a God who commands the mitzvah. The very notion of a mitzvah is meaningless unless there is a God who commands the mitzvah. Hence, the notion of a God who commands is outside of and antecedent to any list of mitzvahs. Or in the words of the Ramban, it is not proper to be counted among them. But then if belief in God is not commanded, what makes belief in God incumbent upon us? To be sure, if there is no obligation to believe in the existence of God, then the very notion of a mitzvah in the sense of a binding obligation is devoid of meaning. The answer of Baal Lachos Gedolos must be that belief in God is prior to acceptance of any and all commandments. Moreover, acceptance of the notion of a duty to fulfill God's will must be antecedent to imposition of any particular duty. The proposition that it is incumbent upon man to obey the will of God must then be an a priori proposition that is not contingent upon dogmatic revelation. Sajigonin is in Munus Fideus, in the third treatise in the first parak, declares that, and I quote, logic demands that whoever does something good be compensated either by means of a favor shown him, if he is in need of it, or by means of thanks, if he does not require any reward. Indeed, for if Sadi Gaon, the commandments that he classifies as mitzvah sichlius, or mitzvahs that reason make imperative, is implanted in our minds, i.e., it is a priori in nature, the obligation to obey the will of God can best be compared to the natural inclination of children to obey a parent that may well be regarded as an intuitive response occasioned by the many acts of beneficence performed by the parent on behalf of his or her child. Kal v'chomer, the benefits provided by Hashem on behalf of his children give rise to a similar innate recognition. That is to say that obedience to the will of God is a principle of natural law. The notion, even in the absence of a revealed commandment, that one must obey the will of God, or better, that one dare not thwart the divine intent, is supported by a number of medieval commentaries in their elucidation of the statement of the Gemara in Baba Kama 85a, Verapo Yerape, from here we see that a physician was granted authority to heal. The problem with regard to this rabbinic text is obvious. Why is it necessary for the Torah to grant explicit license for the practice of medicine? That which is not forbidden is presumed to be permitted. There is no hint of a biblical interdiction banning the practice of medicine. If so, why is there a need for a scriptural passage to permit that which is not forbidden? Tosis and the Rashba resolve the problem by stating that absent explicit permission, a person who intervenes in physiological processes in order to cure ailments appears as if he is thwarting a decree of the king. Rashi expresses the same concept in describing the ostensive nature of the physician's professional conduct in the form of rhetorical exclamation, God afflicts and the physician cures. The import of this exegetical comment is that but for the verse, Verapo Yerape, we'd be a nation of faith healers to whom the practice of medicine is forbidden. Physiological disorders are the result of divine providence. Providence is the manifestation of divine will. Ergo, any attempt to cure sickness by means of human intervention is an attempt to frustrate the divine will. The only conceivable reason that such an endeavor would be interdicted is that man is duty-bound to surrender to the will of God. Since there is no revealed commandment admonishing man to obey the will of God, such a duty must be apprehended by human intellect without need of a dogmatic decree. The duty, then, is in the form of a natural law obligation. Even if Rav Sadia's depiction of mitzvah sichlius is not accepted, the duty to obey the will of God must be regarded as a natural law principle. Since, as already noted, that obligation cannot be born of revelation because, in the absence of such a duty, there would be no obligation to obey revealed laws. Rambam must also have recognized that the obligation is a priori in nature. Presumably, Ramban's contention that belief is in the existence of God is a meta-principle logically prior to acceptance of the legal corpus of Judaism, and hence not binding solely as a mitzvah posited by that legal system, would have readily been conceded by Rambam. Rambam's inclusion of Anochi Hashem Elokecha as one of the 613 mitzvahs must be understood as flowing from his recognition that the term mitzvah in that context is not to be understood in the conventional sense of mitzvah. Rambam's enumeration is an elucidation of Rav Simlai's dictum in Makkos 23b that 613 mitzvahs were revealed by Moshe. Said Rav Amnuna, Moshe commanded the Torah thus, Torah tziva lanu Moshe, Torah 611 in Gematria, Anochi and Lo Yielecha are the other two. We heard that directly mipi Agvura from Hashem at 613. As understood by the Rambam, the term mitzvahs employed in that dictum should not be translated as commandments, but as having a more fundamental meaning. A commandment is an exhortation designed to generate an effective response, positive or negative, in terms of human conduct. That is how the term mitzvah is generally used, but the root meaning of the term mitzvah signifies simply a matter regulated or governed by revelation. Of course, all mitzvahs are governed by revelation, but not all mitzvahs are divinely mandated imperatives. The Chofetz Chaim is reputed to have commented that there are not 613 mitzvahs, but 613 inyanim, or subjects contained in the Torah. The meaning of that observation is that there are 613 matters governed or regulated by revelation, not all of which are necessarily commanded in the sense of being either mandated or prescribed. Thus, in divorcing a wife, a man should not anticipate reward for fulfilling a mitzvah sase. Yet divorce is one of the enumerated mitzvahs. The meaning of a mitzvah in that context is simply that the Torah created the institution of divorce as a means of severing the marital bond without either mandating or forbidding a person to avail himself of that halachic expedient. Divorce, when initiated, must be carried out in a particular manner. It is the availability of divorce and its mode of execution that constitutes a mitzvah in the sense of being the product of its tzivui, or divine ordinance. Belief in God is tantamount to an a priori concept, and the duty to obey God's will is known by light of reason alone. Nevertheless, the complexities regarding the nature of God as a unitary and corporeal being are not necessarily known a priori, but can be deduced on the basis of logical reasoning, and were made known to man, even to the unsophisticated, on the basis of revelation. Thus, there is no substantive controversy between the Baal Lachos Gedolos and Rambam. Rather, Baal Lachos Gedolos understood Rav Simlai as to be using the term mitzvah in its usual sense, thereby rendering its application to belief in God inappropriate. Rambam, in contrast, understands the term as meaning regulated or defined by revelation, a sense in which the term mitzvah is applicable to belief in God as well. Although this basic understanding of Baal Lachos Gedolos is self-evident, it is probably best expressed by Rav Elchanan Wasserman in his Biur HaGadlus HaShas, published as an addendum to his Kovetz HaOris. Rav Elchanan questions how a Benoyach can be responsible for obeying the Noahide commandments. Gentiles did not have the benefit of revelation, nor do they have an unbroken Mesorah regarding the contents of the Noahide code. For that matter, their history does not include a collective confirmatory experience of the divine in the form of revelation or prophecy. Consequently, many, if not most, goyim may be said to live in a state of invincible ignorance. Ignorance of the law may be no excuse. A person should inform himself of the contents of the law. But ignorance of the existence of a legal system itself should serve as a complete exoneration. How can a person be required to seek information regarding a system of law of whose existence he is entirely ignorant? How then can non-Jews be held accountable for breach of the Noahide Code? Rochana's response is that every intelligent person is aware of the existence of God. Rochana develops a rudimentary argument from design in asserting that every person can perceive that the universe must be a product of an intelligent being, i.e. Hashem. Rochana proceeds to argue not simply that there is an a priori duty to obey the will of God, but that there is also a concomitant duty to seek to determine whether God has made his will known to man. The quest for that information should ultimately direct a persevering inquirer to the teachings and traditions of Judaism. Rav Elchanan not only confirms what may be described as a natural obligation to obey the command of God, but also a natural obligation to ascertain whether God has revealed his will to men. So that is part one. And Yitzhak Hashem Darkenu, we will continue in the next segment, B'li Neder, with more. May Hashem give us life and health and the financial means and the Simchas Chaim to be zocha to continue. B'simcha b'tuv loivav, merov kol, shalom, shalom, sweetest and most beloved friends. Thank you for listening.